to compromise. But I would lecture, but you have a right, and I would rather appreciate if you would interrupt my lecture in case you have a question. This is my policy. I was doing it myself for many, many years. My policy is that if you don't interrupt me, you will want to ask me a question. So I would appreciate if you should interrupt me and something is not clear or you have a question, and if you disagree with me. Yes. This is not a loudspeaker. It's not a loudspeaker. If you are, there's no loudspeaker here. Anyway, I believe it will be my philosophy of religion at many levels. The modern philosophy of religion, comparative philosophy of religion, medieval philosophers, Jewish and Christian, and so forth and so on. My training basically was not in the field of philosophy of religion, but the philosophy of science. Kantian, neo-Kantian philosophy. So perhaps I had a strange approach to philosophy of religion, as my training was not a theological one or exclusively in the field of philosophy of religion or religious thought. However, I was seen as being, so to say, carefully or thrusting, using an expression by Heidegger in a certain environment where philosophy of religion was considered important. I tried to interpret, Jewish religious concepts in philosophical terms. To tell you that I know much about it, I would not be sincere. Basically, I am very perplexed, and perhaps as perplexed as anybody else and more. And I don't believe that Judaism is a philosophy, is a religion, and it is many answers, like the Catholic philosophy. Judaism has many problems, but it's very few answers, very few. And perhaps the more I lecture, the more perplexed you will be, and the more I'll take you here instead of clearing up some problems in your mind. But it's good if you can see a problem and understand the problem is insoluble. And actually, in my mind it says that to be perplexed does not mean to be confused. And whatever I'll say, I'm not laying claim to any theoretical or cognitive validity. I don't know whether what I'm going to say is true or not. It's hard to say. We don't have criteria by which objectively to judge our opinions about Judaism. We have no laboratory, we have no tests. The empirical approach we have, is just, I wouldn't say as developed as in the field of positive science. All I'll say to you is just my own subjective thoughts and feelings about Judaism. I have tried to interpret Judaism in modern times. For the Jew in his encounter with the modern world, I've tried very hard. But it's only a subjective experience and a subjective interpretation on my part. I'm not out to convert anybody. I'm not carrying the gospel of Judaism. I lack missionary zeal. Whatever I'll do, take it as an act of confidence on my part, as confessing, or rather letting you share my own subjective experience, my own private experience. If you should find that my experience and yours, there is some commensurability between your feelings and my experience, my efforts will be rewarded. However, if you should find that my experience and your experience are incommensurable, incongruous, then you'll disagree with me totally, I will not feel hurt. But it's very hard to say for measurability just in private experience of many different individuals. So the truth of the meeting actually is strictly for measurability. In general, whoever speaks about Judaism and makes an authoritative statement, I'm not saying about Jewish law, but about Jewish philosophy, is wrong.
It's just a subjective interpretation. We have no authority to determine which philosophy is the perennial Jewish philosophy and which one is just a modern ancient interpretation of Judaism. Now, I believe that the topic of our lectures would deal with man and his social institutions, he created. But today I wouldn't speak about man. I'll just give an introduction as to the methodology of Judaism and how you can approach this problem. Judaism has a doctrine of man. Because it has no doctrine of man, so we could get up and go home. As a matter of fact, such a doctrine underlies every civilized religion. Any civilized religion, not only Judaism, Christianity and Islam, must have a doctrine of man. Since religion is concerned with the relationship, with the triple relationship of God, man, and the world, this is the basic relationship in any philosophy of religion, it must necessarily possess some knowledge, on the one hand, of God's infinite will, which conveys to man the moral law, and the means by which this moral law is to be realized, and, on the other hand, of man himself, the subject of the good religious conduct and the ethical norm. Now, let me add something. Cognition, or knowledge, is one of the main motives which determine and shape the religious experience. The homo religiosus, I mean the technical term, means the man of religious experience. The homo religiosus is engaged in a cognitive gesture. He's basically a theoretical man, a homo theoreticus, the anthropos theoreticus. The intellectual urge is as potent in him as it is in the homo theoreticus. Curiosity prompts both the homo religiosus and the homo theoreticus to face the world and men in an inquisitive mood of inquiry. I am saying that because many theories in the history of philosophy and religion have maintained that religion is not a cognitive gesture. It's either a Schleiermacher wanted us to believe an emotional gesture. And the main, so to say, the main experience of the homo religiosus can be reduced to the feeling of absolute dependence, or as Kant and the Neo-Kantian school maintain, the religious experience is an ethical one, the moral experience, the experience of the absolute intent. So Schleiermacher sentimentalized religion, Kant ethicized. Both of them have eliminated the intellectual urge of the homo religiosus. The homo religiosus doesn't want to know, but he wants to act. That's what Kant says. Schleiermacher says the homo religiosus doesn't want to know, nor does he want to act. He feels something. He is emotionally unique, however intellectually, volitionally, ethically, morally, there is no unity, no singularity. However, it's impossible to maintain this attitude, particularly in modern religion. The religious experience has basic, central, intellectual, or cognitive motifs, like the homo theoreticus, whoever he is, scientist, psychologist, philosopher, the religious person is a person who seeks knowledge. Of course, the objectives and hence the methods of the homo religiosus and the homo theoreticus are different. They vary. The homo theoreticus studies a reality bounded in by finitude. You don't know of any other reality. Finitude and reality are identical. whose multifarious complexities are reduced or can be reduced to relational, formal, mathematical equations, and to a system of the dynamic interdependence, whose rationale of reality, and science must believe in the rationale of reality, but otherwise the scientists would never approach reality in a confident mood. There is a rationale in reality, whose rationale manifests itself in expressibility and technological applicability. This is approach on the part of the scientist to reality. The homo religiosus explores being at a different level, not so much for the sake of discovering the here and now knowable, explainable, and useful aspect. He's also interested in that. But his main interest centers about something else. He's not so much interested in the, so to say, in the knowledge of reality which is accessible to us, but is more interested in transcending the charted lanes of an orderly and neatly arranged cosmos or universe and venturing into the unknown, into remote empty distances and boundless stretches, into a strange and puzzling and baffling world which can neither be mathematized or interpreted, or not interpreted in abstract constructs and concepts, whose total equation, because for the homo theoretical, the total equation of the universe is knowable. So, if the universe were not knowable, comprehensible, there would be actually a gesture of resignation for scientists or the homo theoretical. The equation, the total equation of the homo religiosus, says existence is a paradoxical affair, a mysterium magnum, which inspires in man awe and tremor. Of course, ladies and gentlemen, in order to arrive at such an absurd equation, or, if I may use Kierkegaard's expression, to perform the movement of resignation, which is basic for the homo religiosus, homo religiosus must resign from time to time. In order to perform the act or the movement of complete resignation, the homo religiosus must explore every nook and corner of reality. Examine, search every aspect of being and try to interpret even the minutest process of reality. Because the act of resignation on the part of the homo religiosus is not to be equated with the naivete of the uninitiated, ignorant person who denies the worth of knowledge because he doesn't know anything. Not to be afraid. Wherever the homo religiosus is, he must not be an ignorant person, nor must he be an arrogant person. Ignorance and arrogance are certain traits which are completely, and they are strange to the religious experience, incommensurate with the religious awareness. I mean, this skepticism, which flows from an arrogant attitude, is alien to the homo religiosus. The act of resignation on the part of the homo religiosus is rather to be compared with the skepticism of the ecclesiastic or the despair of Faust. I agree. who because of having attained great intellectual heights, because of their incessant drinking from the fountainhead of wisdom, and their mastery of the cognitive gesture, and their unsatiable curiosity, have arrived at the conclusion that being is an insoluble equation. But it is a resignation which follows knowledge and completes the act of knowing, not an act of resignation which precludes knowledge. Because to resign before one knows is not resignation. This is arrogance and ignorance. Of course, only the mathematician can prove that certain equations are insoluble. The person is not initiated in mathematics cannot prove that. The homo religiosus is the mathematician who tries to prove, who feels, that the total equation of reality is an insoluble one, perhaps a great mystery. But he is a man of knowledge. He is an intellectual. He is driven by the so-called, if I may use a Kantian expression, the metaphysical impulse. He wants to know. Not only wants to act, not only he feels differently, he wants to know. And of course, the homo religiosus knows of and is concerned to these and is guided by and by existential purposes which surpass the boundary lines of finitude. True. He's also in another respect, he's different from the scientist. The scientist studies only reality which is bounded in by finitude, by the frames of reference of time and space. However, the homo religiosus knows of another existence. I wouldn't say another existence, because this would sound a little too theological, but as an existence which transcends the boundaries of finitude. And the boundaries of finitude which is conditioned by temporality. Yet, irrespective of the ultimate end which religion pursues, and which is above and outside the worldly ambitions and aspirations of the homo theoreticus, irrespective of that, the drama of religion unfolds only within the confines of our natural order. It means within the confines of this worldliness. Right here and now, and this is basically Jewish, right here and now, in a world of sound and color, of sensuous complexity, of change and development, of mechanical motion, and unalterable processes, the homo man has his rendezvous with infinity, with God. In order to meet God, one does not have to transcend this world. Although perhaps he knows of a higher existence, but meeting God, and this is basically Jewish, perhaps Christianity disagrees. And I would say medieval Christianity. And this respect will come later, this point, we'll refer on this point. The Jewish opinion was, Jews always said, Judaism, that one meets God right here and now, within the confines of time and space. Here and now, in the midst of the events, of a world of events and things, of mechanical order, man rises to great heights and meets his creator, and he also falls into bottomless abyss of sin and actually inferior existence. Right here and now, he rebels against God and his authority, which he accepted prior to his rebellion. And right here and now, he returns to God meekly and humbly, like a child who apologizes to his father, against whom he rebelled a while ago. But it's in the right here and now reality. Right here and now, man struggles with absurdity and insensateness and tries to infuse meaning into something unknown which we call existence. If, of course, gentlemen, the theater of religious activities, of religious self-expression and self-realization is to be found here in our sensuous world, then understanding of an acquaintanceship with the latter, with this world, is a conditio sine qua non for the proper guiding, for the proper realization of our religious destiny. So it means what I wanted to say is that religion lays claim to knowledge, and this knowledge does not pertain to eternity, or to some transcendental entity, or to some spiritual beings, but religion wants to know this world, this corporeal, sensuous world, in all its manifestations, and in all its, so to say, at all its levels. Like the scientists or the homo theoretics. And of course, ladies and gentlemen, it is a truism that although the cognitive gesture of the homo religiosus is a comprehensive one, aiming at reality in its entirety, manifesting itself in a variety of orders, the homo religiosus is mainly concerned with the order of personal existence. Or to be more exact, with himself. Of course, he wants to know the world, certainly. No doubt about it. But he's more concerned with himself. Perhaps there is a distinction between the homo theoreticus and the homo religiosus. The homo theoreticus, until recently, was more concerned with the outside world, with the physical process, with motion, since the days of Thales. He was more concerned with the organic matter, with the process of life, which is also, I mean, belongs into the outside world. He was less concerned with himself, the scientist, because simply the scientist had been concerned with himself as much as he was concerned with the outside world, with dead matter and animate matter. Then perhaps psychology and sociology, all the humanities, would have progressed much more. Because actually knowledge of man is a late comer in the history of science. The newcomer, actually. All right, in history of philosophy, you know, Socrates said, what is man? But it was a different approach. It was not knowledge, theoretical knowledge. It was more a practical problem. What should man do in order to be happy? This was the general problem of the Greek philosophers. Not who is man, what is man, what is the existential experience, what kind of a being he is, what is his uniqueness, singularity, his station in the world, in the universe, I mean, his struggle with the outside world, his struggle with himself. No, this was not a problem of Socrates, nor was it a problem of Aristotle or Plato, his master Plato, nor was it a problem of the Stoics and the Epicurean school. The problem was a practical one, a pragmatic one, a functional problem. How can man be happy? How can he attain eudaimony, or what they call it, pleasure, hedone? It's a practical problem. And the whole discussion about man in Greek philosophy, in the late antique, I mean, in the Greek philosophy, from Socrates and down. So it did not revolve about the metaphysics of man or theory of man. It was more revolving about the practical discipline of man. How can man be happy? It's a technological problem about man, not a theoretical problem. And you know very well that technological problems cannot be solved unless you do basic research. And this was the trouble with the Greek philosophy. When it came, I mean, to the outside world, they were pure theoreticians. The pragmatic view did not persuade them at all. They wanted to understand for the sake of knowledge. Of course, you know, the idea of technology was alien to the Greeks, completely, because the type of knowledge he was pursuing did not lend itself to technological application. However, when it came to man himself, he suddenly turned into a technician. Not who is man, what is man, but how should man act in order to be. And of course, the homo religiosus is concerned with man and has a double problem. Who is man? And also the old Greek problem, the pragmatic problem. What shall a man do in order, to realize or to find self-fulfillment? Religion must possess intimate knowledge and understanding at all levels of the existential experience, or what we call self-awareness. Otherwise, the God-man relationship could remain an enigma to the homo religiosus. If he doesn't understand himself, how can he approach God? However universally true the aforementioned maxim is, that the homo religiosus is intellectual type and is particularly interested in self-knowledge, it is true. Various religions differ as to the manner in which they emphasize the above-mentioned cognitive aspects of the homo religiosus. While most religious when I say most religious systems, I am referring to Occidental religion. I have very little knowledge of Oriental religion. I have no right to speak, not even to mention it. Occidental religion, I understand Christianity and Islam. I'm quite well acquainted with the Christian scholastics. Most religious systems were more prone to the theological thinking and developed philosophic doctrines, focusing their attention upon transcendental reality. And they developed only latent religious anthropologies. To distinguish it from scientific anthropology, we call religious anthropology. They say religious anthropology, it means the metaphysics of man, the interpretation of man, formulated in religious terms. Of course, for instance, Christianity, they have a social philosophy, no doubt about it. Thomas Aquinas developed it. Quite an extensive social philosophy based upon natural law, lex naturalis or lex naturae. But however, it's funny, it's strange, they developed a social philosophy without inquiring into the essence of man. How can you develop a social philosophy before you inquire into man for himself? Regardless of all the controversies about the relationship of man for himself, man within the community, we'll come later to this problem, this controversy. The community perceives the individual perceives the community, systematically, conceptually. But however, Thomas Aquinas was not concerned with the problem who is man. He was concerned, what is society? And that is the reason why social philosophy is incomplete, because it lacks the basic, so to say, the basic premise, knowledge of man for himself, man in seclusion. Man communing not with the other self, but man communing with himself. That's only lately, Christian philosophy began to develop. And actually, this effect of religious anthropology dealing with the individual. And of course, this is what we know, what's known to us, under the name or the title religious existentialism. Well, there are many books that were written about religious existentialism. What it is, it means the philosophy of man, the property, the supreme thought of Christianity. That is exactly, more or less, if we want to simplify this equation. However, Judaism occupies a very unique, how to say, position in the world of religion. While other religions stressed the idea of God more than that of man, Judaism, in its intellectual pursuit, concentrated on man. And religious anthropology replaced in Judaism theology. We have always inquired into the essence of man, never into the essence of God. And our world formula is quite paradoxical. It is theocentric, God-centric, theocentric. However, anthropo-oriented. We are orientated on man. We concentrate, so to say, more teleologically on God. Of course, God is the beginning and the ultimate end of everything. Judaism maintains that as any other civilized religion. Because it is not the beginning and the end of everything, there is no need for religion. I can never understand that religion becomes so modernized that the idea of God is eliminated. Not that the zeal of the fanatic, I mean, is that what makes me rebel against it, but a simple question. This is religion, so there is no need to spend so much money on its institutions. We are theocentric, but anthropo-orientated. Of course, God is the beginning and the ultimate end of everything. In him, the fullness of existence is realized, and all yearnings of man find fulfillment. No doubt about it. It's very important for the therapeutic aspect of religion. Yes, God himself, creator of the world, out of whose pure absolute, infinite being, finitude emerge, God himself remains to us Jews, Keum istater, the Shastra saying, Deus absconditus, a mysterium tremendum, a hidden God, inapproachable, unknowable, inexpressible, eluding the grasp of our senses. And if you'll allow me, I want you to just raise one dichotomy, to call your attention to one dichotomy, or rather to an antithesis in our religious experience. Our experience of God, the Judaic experience of God, of course, I mean, you'll find it in other religions as well. But particularly the Judaic experience of God is antithetic. Insofar, it contains an awareness of both, of endless remoteness and mystery on one hand, and of intimate closeness and familiarity on the other. Don't ask me how it is possible. But basically, Judaism, in its approach to God, did not operate with the Aristotelian two-valued logic, or with the famous principle of contradiction or the excluded middle. Aristotle says, if it is A, it cannot be the same time B. If it is B, it cannot be the same time A. It's either A or B. And if it's A or B, it cannot be something else. We say, it's typical of our mentality. It can be A in the same time B. And not only can be A in the same time B, it can be A and the same time B, and also something else than A and B. I mean, you know, ladies and gentlemen, modern physics, classical physics, operates with it. For instance, you know, the theory of light is interpreted nowadays both in terms of waves and in terms of particles. Although both theories are mutually exclusive. So apparently, actually, the modern advanced mathematics and advanced physics actually cannot operate simply. The mesa phenomena does not lend itself to a two-valued logical interpretation. The principle of contradiction and the principle of the exquisite needle was thrown away by the science. But in the religious approach, it's certainly that we operate with antithetic ideas, concepts. On one hand is remote, on the other hand is close. In our encounter with God, we find ourselves many times wound up by the opposition of inexperiential alternatives. First, as I said before, Deus ex condibus, God who is hiding in the depths of infinity and eternity. And second, as the psalmist says, Karov Hashem l'chol korach, the Lord is nigh unto all that call upon him, to all that call upon him in truth and sincerity. He is both, he is nigh and remote. He is near and far away. This is the Jewish experience of God. On the one hand, we experience God as dwelling apart and beyond all dimensions of being, hidden in the remotest recesses of infinity, is unapproachable and incomprehensible, abiding in concealment and in the shadows of transcendence. And the word, the Hebrew word kadosh, holy, whoever knows the etymological meaning of kadosh, know that kadosh actually in Hebrew signifies separated, different, otherness, incommensurability, something which doesn't belong into this area, something mysterious. It signifies the withdrawal of God from this. On the other hand, the homo religiosus feels also the immediate presence of God. His endless remoteness and also the immediate presence of God. Outside and within him, God is man's haven, if you will. His fortress, his habitation, where men reside. The experience of God that is contained, father, mother, friend. Sometimes the words I'm quoting are taken from the Bible. The Bible is the book of the Judaic religious experience. Mother, friend, lover and beloved both together, who caresses his head, bend under the load of existence, and whispers words of condolence and hope. He is the shepherd who cares for the helpless and the weak, and carries the young in his presence. Let's quotation from Isaiah. On the one hand, Deus ex conditus, on the other hand, Deus revelatus, close God. On the one hand, mysterium tremendum, magnum, distant, strange, and unknowable, inspiring dread and awe. And on the other hand, Deus revelatus, involved in creation in every aspect of existence, addressing himself to us through every twinkle of a distant star, through every budding tree, out of the stillness of the summer night, the cry of the infant, and the innocent laughter of the child, who once thought, feeling, striving, and yearning, and on the other hand, distant, incomprehensible, strange, far in infinity, in the recesses of infinity. He confronts us both as an adversary, as an antagonist, and as a friend, as a stranger, and as a father. As a familiar figure, I may use this expression, and as a mysterious person. You know, Jacob, who was wrestling with the stranger, who was the stranger, it's not the same God who spoke to him a night before. The experience is antithetic. That's happening. It's mutually exclusive, but still, this antithesis and this dichotomy actually lends to the religious experience its uniqueness, greatness, and magnificence. What a thought. We must realize, keep in mind, that while the individual homo religios may engage in a paradoxical experience, fraught with incommensurate aspects and incongruous themes, oscillating between complete resignation and passionate, ecstatic joy, the community, the institutionalized religion, must organize its collective experience along coherent patterns, and it cannot afford to tolerate polarity within our religious awareness. What is good for the at an esoteric level is absolutely inoperative at a exoteric level. What is good for the few individuals, for the hominis religiosity, for the great religious genius, is absolutely incomprehensible for the average person. So therefore, if you are going to study the history of religion, you'll find that some religions have emphasized the aspect of remoteness. In some religions, and other religions on the contrary, introduce God as familiar. Although the religious experience, the private religious experience of the homo religiosus has both motifs, the motif of remoteness and the motif of closeness as well. For instance, you take Christianity. Where was the concept of father of son introduced? Why is it? Why was this Trinitarian motif introduced in Christianity? Philosophically? Simply, I mean, whoever reads the literature of the fathers of the desert, read the literature of Saint by Saint Augustine, his Confessions, Speak of God, and so forth on, I mean, that Christianity actually was formed by two motives. By the motive of closeness of God and remoteness of God. By the motive of Deus absolutum, the given God. And by the motive of Deus revelatus, the revealed God. The God is who is close to me, who within me, who has intercourse with me, who is my companion, to whom I can address myself, I can pray. I can complain, I may rebel, I may engage in a dialogue. And the final result was that God's father is the remote one, and the son is the one who was walking on earth, associating with people, speaking to them. That's why in Christianity, in Christian theology, you know very well, all prayers cannot be addressed to the father unless we beseech the son to mediate between us and the father. Why? Because the father is too remote. For prayer cannot reach him. There is no way for man to find access to God Father. That's why we actually simply split divinity into two entities and introduce the Father. And it's the God who is God. Judaism is an Italian religion to the dress. And Judaism is an antithesis, a dichotomy of closeness and remoteness. The question is, what did Judaism do with the problem of its institutionalized religion? Judaism is also. It's a private experience, it's also an institutional religion. Any religion must be institutionalized. I mean, because the word religion itself, I mean, indicates institutionalization. Institutionalized, conceptualized, made, so to say, available to the crowd. So we cannot, you see, for instance, education. There were times when education was considered the privilege of the select few of the aristocratic side. In England, such a system, actually old Greece, I mean, actually believed in aristocracy as far as education system. You can say art. Eliot says that art is only a product of the class of leisure. Okay. But no one can say that religion should be, so to say, limited to the select few. For a simple reason. Because from our viewpoint, religion saves men, giving salvation and redemption. And we think that everybody is entitled to salvation and redemption, not only the philosopher, but the simpleton as well, not only the aristocrat, but the slave as well. So you cannot make turn the religious experience into a new character for the philosopher, for the inquiring mind, for the person who simply encounters God. New ways must be found in order to simplify the religious experience and to make it available and accessible to every person. And the dichotomous religious experience is an esoteric affair. Exoterically, the average person on the street cannot understand the dichotomy. Either or, the principle of contradiction that Aristotle introduced into logic is simply common sense. It's either black or white. It cannot be between red, gray, and red. What either black or either it's the square or it's round. What they are a circle. It cannot be both. So what did Judaism do? What motive was emphasized not in the private experience of God, the Judaic private experience? The Judaic private experience, as it was depicted and described in the Psalms, which is the greatest book on religious experience in general, I believe, and I'm never apologetic about it, but it's the greatest book of the religious experience in general. Everybody has interesting. As far as it's concerned, the psalmist was a religious genius. I mean, the real homo religiosus. In him, you find psalms, the famous psalm, God is my shepherd, I shall not want. So how is God depicted, described there? Close, companion, my shepherd. I associate with him. I engage in a dialogue with him. I bend my tired head on his shoulder, and he whispers into me in words of hope for me. And the same psalmist, the next day, in the next chapter, begins to say, where can I escape from you? Where can I find you? I searched you everywhere. I found you nowhere. I came to your sanctuary, to your temple. I thought I'll find you there, but you are not there. I searched in the woods, but I didn't find your shadow. What? On the one hand, he speaks of God as his companion, his shepherd. On the other hand, the same breath. He says he can't find God, he doesn't know where he is. It's what we say, numen presence, numen absence. God is present and absent.